Tonight, we're continuing to talk about the subject of Bible authority, and we want to pursue that just a little bit further in our study tonight and making applications to the things that we're concerned about. And I'll get them up here in just a minute. When we think about the subject of Bible authority, we need to be able to establish authority for everything that we do, everything that we teach, everything that we practice. And there's a passage that tells us, whatever you do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord. John Grigowski, where is it? Colossians 3:17. There's another passage, Betty Jo, that tells us, as Jesus was asked, by what authority doest thou these things, and who gave thee this authority? Where do I read it? Yes. 23 through 27, yes. Matthew 21, 23 through 27. Randy, we're not under the Old Testament law, and I want to show somebody from the Scriptures that we're not under that system. Where do I go?
A bunch of different places.
Well, help me out there.
Hebrews, the whole book. Galatians 2:21.
Okay.
Colossians 2.
14 through 16. Yes, sir. And there's another one, many others, but you've got Hebrews. Three books that primarily discuss this. What are they? Romans, Galatians, and Hebrews. That's right. And as we discuss, there's one in Matthew that I want you to remember as well, as it talks about the transfiguration of Jesus. Where do I read it? Pardon me? Matthew 17, 1 through 5. What was the significance of the appearance of Moses and Elijah? All right, Moses, the law came through Moses, and Elijah, the prophets. All right, Moses and Elijah represent the Old Testament system. But when Peter said, Lord, it is good for us to be here, let us build three tabernacles. And as he said that, a cloud overshadowed them. And what did the Father say? All right, this is my beloved Son, hear ye him. Now, in our study tonight, we're making application of some of these things. The Bible teaches us in what three ways? Direct statements, approved apostolic examples, and necessary inference. David Skinner, give me an illustration of a necessary inference. What is that? It is. Give me an illustration from Scripture.
Philip and the eunuch went down into the water to be baptized. Now, if baptized consisted of sprinkling, they wouldn't need to go down into the water.
Well, now that is a good one. I've not used that one before, but that is right. That's absolutely right. While you're on that topic of Philip and the eunuch, there's another good one that is in that context. You remember the text tells us that Philip preached unto him Jesus.
Oh, yeah. And so, absolutely, preaching consisted of teaching baptism. Because how did he know about baptism and that he wanted to be baptized?
That's right. You know, one of the things that, as a teacher, that just thrills me to death is to watch the wheels turn and see, I got that. That's right. You're doing good. You're doing good. Now, Randy, as the Bible teaches us in one of three ways, and sometimes a combination of the three, when we look at the approved apostolic examples, I want to see an illustration. All right, we do. Is there any other passage in all of the book of God that tells us when to do that or illustrates when we are to do that, exemplifies? No, that's the only one. Now, while I'm throwing that out and we're discussing that, we talked about that last week, you remember, there are some who make the argument that there are at least two times when the Lord's Supper was observed. One was on a Thursday night. One was on the first day of the week. What are you shaking your head for? No, it wasn't. That's the point. No, it was not. In Jesus instituting the Lord's Supper, he was not observing the Lord's Supper. He was teaching the disciples what they were to do in the kingdom, not observing the Lord's Supper. And the reason I throw that out is that's an argument that some try to make who want to decry the argument that the Scriptures teach by proved apostolic examples. And so you've got to deal with that. No, there's error in trying to affirm that what Jesus did in Matthew 26 and so forth, the parallel text, constitutes the observance of the Lord's Supper. Now, we've got lots of hands. Bruce, Terry, Randy, and Jonathan, in that order. Don't let me forget you. All right, that's true. Mentions the first day of the week. Hold on there, David. We've got to go around the horn. We're going to get to you. Terry.
Well, you couldn't have an observance of that prior to the existence of the kingdom.
Well, that's right. It'd be very difficult for Jesus, for us to observe the Lord's Supper in remembrance of His death, and certainly for Him to observe the Lord's Supper in remembrance of His death before He died. That's right. Got more to say on that. Randy?
I guess I don't understand the argument.
Well, the argument is we have two options. The Lord observed it on Thursday night. The disciples observed it upon the first day of the week. How we know which example to follow? That's the argument. But the Lord did not observe the Lord's Supper on Thursday night. He instituted it. And therefore, we're back to Acts 20. The only example we have of the time is Acts chapter 20. Well, this is true. I mean, there are all kinds of flaws in the argument. But what they're trying to argue, and we need to get focused on this, what they're trying to argue is that the Bible does not teach by approved apostolic examples. Now, there are a lot of things you could say about the Lord's Supper that are wrong in their argument. But what we want to stay focused on, and I'm going to say this to all of you, sometimes focusing an argument on one thing shows the error of the argument. And you remember last time we made the point that if somebody makes this argument to you and it does not pass the test of Acts 20, it fails. That's the proving ground of this argument, because that is one example that we only have one of. Only one. Now, as we're talking in our study tonight about benevolence, there are numerous examples of churches engaging and cooperating in the realm of benevolence. But when you take the position, the Bible does not teach by approved apostolic examples. I don't have to show you multiple points that cause your argument to fail. All I've got to do is show you one. Just one. And I'm going to make this suggestion. You will be hearing this argument. It's somewhat new in making the loop, but you will hear this argument. And I want you to know how to answer it. And when you hear this argument, friend, don't you dare let somebody take you here, 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 and here. If anybody starts that, you bring them right back to Acts 20. Don't allow yourself to make an argument from here, 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 and here. You stay focused on Acts chapter 20, verse 7, and make them answer it. If you allow yourself to go all over the board, you'll spend several hours and get nowhere. It's like shooting buckshots. You won't accomplish a thing in a discussion. But if you make somebody answer this argument, you've got to answer this. Keep the pressure on. Answer this. Now, where you're going to wind up, I'll just promise you, been there, done that, where you're going to wind up when you press that point, somebody's going to say, well, the Lord's Supper then is just a matter of conscience. Now, if you have this argument, you watch it. That's where it'll go. The time that you observe the Lord's Supper, as far as the frequency or the day, is just a matter of conscience. Now, here's where you want to go with that when they make that argument. If it's just a matter of conscience, then it's a matter of liberty. Paul deals with matters of conscience. He deals with matters of conscience in 1 Corinthians chapter 8, 9, and 10, and in Romans chapter 14. That's the only passages in all the book of God where that's addressed with some detail. Now, you think about it. And when he's dealing with matters of conscience, he's dealing in the realm of liberty. That is, things that you may do, but you don't have to do. Now, if somebody says, I can observe the Lord's Supper on Sunday because that's just my conviction, but I can't condemn you if you want to do it on Thursday night because it's just a matter of conscience, then you show them that that argument then places the Lord's Supper, Acts 20, right over into the realm of liberty. Now, you know what the realm of liberty is? What is it?
Don't violate somebody else's conscience.
Yes, but go a step further with it. Just plain old Kentucky terms. What is it if you put something over into the realm of liberty? It's optional. It's your opinion or my opinion. It just don't matter. Now, if you press somebody, I mean you keep the pressure on. Acts chapter 20, verse 7. Just keep hammering it. That's where you'll go. Now, if you follow them all around the board, you won't get there. And you might have a 2 or 3 or 4 hour discussion. But you don't let somebody lead you on a rat chase across the country. You hammer Acts 20, verse 7. You just keep hammering it. And the reason is, that is the only example, the only one, that we have in all of the book of God that discusses the day of observing the Lord's Supper. So you want to hammer that one.
Now, Acts 20 and 7 is not only an example, but we have necessarily inferred that they had the Lord's Supper on the first day of the week because they were taught to do so.
Well, that's right, but that takes you back to Acts 20, and you can make that point. But one of the things that you don't want to do when you're in a discussion like this is introduce passages that's going to give the fellow that's teaching error a direction where he can skirt the point that you're trying to make. Don't let that happen. You keep hammering the text of Acts 20, verse 7. You're right. You can go to Acts 2, 42 and show that under the instructions of the apostles, this is what they did. Now, why did the apostles teach this? That's exactly what the Lord told them to teach when He instituted the Lord's Supper. I have no problem with making those arguments. But once said, don't let the fellow you're discussing with take that and run. You stay on Acts 20, verse 7, and the reason is that's the only example that discusses the day. Now, you can let somebody take you here, yonder, and where, and you won't get that question answered. But if you keep hammering that question, and hammering it, you're going to get out of the fella. It's just a matter of opinion. There's no other place to go. Well, what you've done is you've exposed his error. Because once you've exposed his error, most brethren are not willing to accept that. That's a consequence of somebody's position. That's just simply unacceptable. What that suggests is that the Lord has told us to do something very specific, but He's left the door completely open as to when you do it. Just a matter of opinion. Now that's an unacceptable conclusion. Here's an act of worship that we find parallels to it, such as the Passover, such as the Sabbath. All of these are pinpointed, but you come down to the very main, if you please, thing, the memorial service celebrating the death of Christ and His resurrection. And you're proclaiming the Lord's death till He comes. And somebody said, it was just a matter of opinion. Now you've boiled it down to its bottom line. And somebody makes that argument, the discussion's over. All right? Did I get everybody? Dave and then Roy. I missed you, Jonathan. I'll get back to you. Don't let me forget. Yours has been covered? All right, Jonathan.
I'm the same way after all that. I can't follow anything. Roy?
I'm
just asking, that's the only place in the Bible where it's mentioned?
That's the only place in all of the book of God where the observance of the Lord's Supper specifies the day, and that's in an example. All right, Daryl? Well, okay. Well, we'll do that another time instead of using our class time for that, because I want to go on with the things that we prepared that are pertinent to our study of the subject of benevolence. But it's not hard to do. In fact, I just about did that. I've just not too long ago had about a 2.5 hour discussion with someone on this very point. And the arguments that are made begin with the premise that New Testament examples are not binding. It begins with the idea that commandments bind, examples simply illustrate. Now it makes you wonder, well, what do they illustrate? What do they illustrate? Now you keep hammering this point because Acts chapter 20 is a unique example. It's unique in the sense that it's the only one that mentions the day in which we are to gather to break bread. It's the only one. Now, if somebody's going to make the argument that commandments bind and all examples do is just illustrate, well then, if you keep that argument going, you're going to force the fellow who holds that position to conclude that when we observe the Lord's Supper, it's just a matter of opinion. That's got to be where he winds up if he says that examples only illustrate, because illustrations tell us, well, you may or you may not do this. But that example tells us the day. Now, if examples mean anything at all, that communicates to us when God wants that done. Now, of course, the fellow that I was discussing this with argued that examples don't mean anything at all. Now, if that be true, then his conclusion would logically follow. It's just a matter of opinion. It doesn't make any difference when you do it.
Did he use the argument that because it doesn't say that the Lord's Supper only?
No. No. Well, he did make an argument on, he called the doctrine that you and I believe Sunday-only doctrine. That's what he called it, Sunday-only doctrine. But you see, sometimes, Darrell, we want to assign to somebody that we're discussing things with a term. We want to call you by something that in and of itself becomes prejudicial. Now, you can call me what you want to call me, and we're going to see some of that here. But that doesn't answer the argument I've made to you. Calling me names don't answer the argument. Now, that's what so many have done on this. Now, we, in our last discussion, have talked about three possibilities in which the church did its work of benevolence. We saw that the needy saints in Jerusalem were supplied by the church in Jerusalem. Here are the passages. We saw also that the church at Antioch supplied the needs of the brethren that dwelt in Judea. Now, we've noted in Galatians chapter 1, this should be in your memory passage list, Galatians chapter 1, verse 22, that there were a number of churches in Judea. There were a plurality of churches in Judea. Paul speaks of the churches, plural, of Judea. Now, the significance of that is that when those at Antioch sent to their brethren in Judea, it tells us that they sent to churches in Judea. They did not send to the Jerusalem church and then make the Jerusalem church a sponsoring church to disperse the funds throughout Judea.
That brought up another question. I know it's mentioned in our questions too, but I'm going to forget it, I'm sure.
I probably would. Go ahead.
In Acts 11, where it talks about Antioch sending Paul and Barnabas out to deliver the funds for the churches in Judea, it says churches in Judea, and then in Acts 12 and 25 it says that Barnabas and Saul returned from Jerusalem when they had fulfilled their ministry, and then they brought back with them John Mark.
All right.
So, I know that's just one of the specific churches in Judea.
Yeah.
But that could also be used just to argue, well, they went only to Jerusalem.
It is used. I've heard it used. Some make the argument that Acts 12, verse 25, in that they returned from Jerusalem to Antioch. Well, that's where they went. And so they gave these funds to the elders of the church in Jerusalem, and the church in Jerusalem then had the authority to disperse them throughout the province of Judea. Now, we want to answer that, don't we? Okay? The answer to that is that one group of elders does not have oversight over a province. Now, where we want to go to that? We want to look at 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 2, in Acts chapter 20, verse 28, both of these passages that limit the oversight of elders. Acts 20, verse 28 says, to those Ephesian elders, take heed unto yourselves and to all the flock of God over the which the Holy Spirit made you bishops. Now, what flock did the Holy Spirit make the Ephesian elders bishops over? The church in Ephesus, that's right. Now, in 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 2, when he tells those elders as a fellow elder, the Apostle Peter was, he said, take heed, or tend, rather, the flock which is among you. Now, does that mean then that the elders of the church at Jerusalem could receive these funds and have the responsibility as a sponsoring church to disperse these funds throughout other churches? You see, they're not tending the flock that is among them when they do that. So now you have elders exercising authority beyond that which God has given them. And that's the answer to that argument. At least that's one of them.
Right, so you have to pull from the other examples of
The other commands. That's right. These are commandments. And so the commandments that we see in Acts 20, verse 28, and in 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 2, restrict the practice that those at Antioch obviously engaged in. The apostles were there. And so are the apostles then going to participate in? Paul was. Is he going to participate in and demonstrate something that is contrary to what Luke recorded in Acts 20, verse 28? And is he going to participate in and act contrary to what Peter revealed in 1 Peter 5, 2? You see, that won't work. So whatever Paul and Barnabas did and whatever they had instructed the church in Antioch to do is consistent with other teaching. Acts 20, verse 28, 1 Peter 5, verse 2. Now, those are the passages to answer the argument. Now, when we look at some logical means to answer the argument, let's suppose that I go to Richard's house, I go to Harvey's house, I go to Randy's house, and then I go to your house, and then I go to Chris's house. And so somebody writes about Mick's activities for that day, and he said, you know, he returned from Jonathan's house to Chris's house. Does that mean that your house was the only one I visited? Is that a logical conclusion? Now that's the conclusion that some come to when they make these arguments. Well, they came back from Jerusalem to Antioch. Therefore, Jerusalem was the only church they visited. No, it won't work because it's inconsistent with the commandments and restrictions placed upon the oversight of elders. Plus, it's not logical. It's not a forced conclusion, you see. It is a possible conclusion if it were not for these other passages. But we have these other passages. So that makes it an illogical conclusion. All right, Terry? Does that answer? All right, Terry?
Well, additionally, that argument from the 25th verse that Jonathan mentioned, if you take up that argument, what you're doing is, just like in many areas of religion, you have to read something into the text that, in fact, is not there.
That's true. That's true.
You have to read the word only.
That's true.
The text, it does not exist.
That's true. Be like the arguments on faith.
Right.
Same thing. Doesn't say faith only. Well, it says it one time, but it's not by faith only. David? All right. Well, I want to look at some other things as we pursue. Here's what we're looking at, Acts 11, verses 27 through 30. And here's the third possibility. Many churches sending to only one church. Now, we've looked at these Bible examples. We've seen what the New Testament church did. We've looked at the command of 1 Corinthians 16, 1, 2, and 3, where Paul said, as I gave order to the churches of Galatia, so also do ye. Now, it's difficult for me, and you probably observed that by now, to come across a passage such as this one, where I've had some experience in correspondence or discussion with somebody who made something absolutely ludicrous from the passage. A good friend of mine, was several years ago, made the argument on 1 Corinthians chapter 16, verses 1 and 2, that really they didn't maintain a common treasury. Didn't do it. He said really what they did is they took up a collection when there was a need. And when they took up the collection to supply the need, that was the end of the collection. They did not maintain a common treasury. Now, I've heard that question a lot, and in particular, I've heard it circle again in some more recent years. Now, young people, I want you to get this. It's rare that anybody makes a new argument. It's the same old thing, just dressed up in new clothes. It's the same old argument. Same old argument. Now, those who made that argument, in more recent, in times gone by, this fellow did. They didn't maintain a treasury. That they just collected it, and it was for this purpose, and then when the purpose was expended, no more collection, no more treasury. I want to ask you a question. What passage in the New Testament talks about a collection except this one? These that we have on the board. This collection that was for the needy saints in Jerusalem. Do you know of any passage that talks about a collection other than these? Randy?
The only thing close would apostles, Jesus and the apostles had a money box.
All right, I'll grant that. Okay, right? But that was for the work of Jesus and the apostles, which Judas stole from. Yeah, yeah. All right. I'll grant that.
Acts 2 and 5.
All right, when we talk about Barnabas and Ananias and Sapphira, who lied and died in 5, that works. Yeah, that works. But we still see a common treasury in Jerusalem. That's what they were contributing to. All right? So let's go again. Can you think of anything except the Jerusalem church now, Acts 2, 4, and 6, and these illustrations of the needy saints in Jerusalem, where we see any indication that early Christians maintained a treasury? Do you see one? Now, in every one of these, go ahead before we get to the punchline.
I was going to say it's necessarily inferred that if a preacher's going to be paid, he's going to be paid out something.
Now, you stole my punchline. I'm going to reach back there and swat you. You got my punchline. Well, we noticed in our previous lesson that 1 Corinthians 9:14 teaches that preachers may be supported. They that live of those who preach the gospel are worthy to live of the gospel. 1 Corinthians 9:14. And we see a whole bunch of illustrations of that. The church at Philippi supported Paul. We noticed that other churches supported Paul while he was at Corinth. 2 Corinthians 11 verses 8 and 9. Where'd they get the money? Yeah.
It wasn't just, we took up and they sent to him continually.
Yeah.
Multiple times.
That's right. So where'd they get the money? What passage are we going to look at to find the money that they sent to Paul? Where did they get the money?
She said it. I just thought.
Linda, run into that. No, they didn't sell cookies. Where did they get the money? When did they collect it, Randy?
Before they sent it to
him. Go ahead.
Run into that. No, you're missing my point. Where did they get the money, Joe?
They collected it when they met, and they met on the first day of the week.
That's right. How do we know that? All right. Well, we have the command to lay by in store, but we find they used it for this purpose, but that's the only context that we have where a day is given for a common collection. So where did they get the money to support the preaching of the gospel? It had to be from this common collection. We find in Ephesians the 4th chapter, beginning at verse 11 down through the end of the chapter, verse 16, the church is authorized to engage in the work of edification. Barnabas, a preacher, was sent from Jerusalem up to Antioch so that he might teach those people, build them up and edify them. Who sent him? Church at Jerusalem. How did he get sent? Where did they get the money to send him? Of the week contribution. Sell cookies. First day of the week contribution. That's right. Now how do we know that? Because that's all that we read about in the Bible. About maintaining a treasury, a collective treasury of the brethren. Now, when you look at that, folks, there are some who want to draw conclusions that are illogical. You've got to answer questions. Where did the money come from? How can you find in your Bible of any other source where the money came from than the first day of the week contributions? True. You don't find any other evidence as to how they financed it. No, you don't. And one other point on 1 Corinthians chapter 16, Paul's idea was in giving them this command, as he had given order to the churches of Galatia, is that there would not be necessity for a collection when he came. What does that suggest to you? They had to lay it up. So there was a common and regular accumulation into a fund. A common treasury. John?
It doesn't really prove anything, but it's kind of neat to see, you know, a plan and the logic behind it when you look at, I guess, the
weren't, you know, if we did not lay aside every week, then we only, you know, barring things like electric bills and rent and stuff like that, you would only give money when it was required. Could you imagine how much less we would do? I mean, the money building up and accumulating kind of, you know.
Well, that's true. But you know, John, I want to go to Arkansas and preach for a congregation that don't have a preacher and don't have any money. Small, small group. I want to leave Sunday. They've got a real desperate need. All right, let's take up a contribution and have enough money to make that trip. Now, you see what Paul's talking about? You lay by in stores so that no collections be made when I come. You've got it ready. When Paul was bringing these from Macedonia down there to Achaia, what was his purpose in telling them, you have this ready? I wrote you a year before. So you've had this ready for a year. What does that suggest the church at Corinth has been doing? Upon the first day of the week, they've been laying into that treasury, haven't they? Now, that's not hard, folks. And when somebody makes a ludicrous argument that we only maintain a treasury when there's an immediate need, that's just foolishness. The Bible teaches that that's not so. There was always a need. There was always the need for the preaching. There was always the need for building up or edifying the saints. There was always the need for some needy brother or needy brethren. That's an ever ongoing present need. And that demands an ever ongoing present treasury out of which to work. Now, anybody have a question about that? Well, good. Let's move on. Three examples. Here's my map that I've been trying to tell you for the last 3 weeks that I need to put in this series of charts. And I want us all to look at this map because here's Ephesus. It was from Ephesus all the way across the Aegean Sea that Paul wrote the 1 Corinthian letter. You'll see that Paul traveled from Ephesus up here to Troas, where he said there was a wonderful opportunity to preach the gospel. Fertile ground. But he said he couldn't stay there. So he traveled on up into Macedonia. And here is Philippi, where Paul said that the church at Philippi was the only one that had contributed to his needs in the preaching of the gospel. Ye only, he said, you sent once and again unto my need, even unto Thessalonica. Now we look at this map and we say, well, that's not very far. That's only a couple of inches or so on a small map. You look at the scale of miles. Now, my scale of miles on this map is not necessarily accurate, Richard, as you know, because I've stretched the map out to fill the page. But, just to give you an idea, you look at this scale of miles. From here to here is about 100 miles. From here to here would be about what? Now, you think about that. That's a long way. Now, how much funds you think it would take you, Randy, to travel 500 miles when you were riding a horse, riding a donkey, or walking? You see. So when Paul says, you sent once and again unto my need, even unto Thessalonica, he's not talking about just over there. He's not talking about like going from Lancaster to Palmdale. He's talking about a long distance of travel, and the church at Philippi during this period of time were the only ones that supported him. Yeah, yeah. Everybody knows where that is, right? That's a long way to walk. It might take you a while to get there. Now, I showed you that map. Now, in addition to that, here we see the pattern. You like to see it in pictures? Church at Jerusalem. Picking out the place, the personnel, the provisions. These are things that the church may determine when there is a benevolent need. Suppose, for example, that Richard and Linda, their house burns down. Takes a while for their insurance to kick in. So Jonathan says, why don't you come over here and share my one-bedroom apartment? Well, what's happened? We look at Richard and Linda and we say, well, you know, Jonathan's got a lot of room in his but one-bedroom apartment. So Terry and I are in agreement to that. Jonathan, that's a good place. But you're going to need some personnel to help you with that. Let's suppose Richard gets injured. So we say, well, you know, Randy back there, he's a pretty good medic. So Randy, we're going to select you and pay you to go over there and take care of Richard's medical problems, all right? But let's suppose that in your going and taking care of Richard, you say, well, I need some bandages. I need some medical supplies. Why, even his clothes burned up. Well, what are we going to look at? Well, the church can provide those things. Now, you see how that is illustrated in this chart? The church can select the place. It can select the personnel. It can select the provisions and provide those things to take care of the needy among them. Now, that's exactly what you've got, beloved, in Acts 2, 4, and 6. That's exactly what you've got. Now, look a little bit further. When we go a little farther in time to Acts, the 11th chapter, the church in Antioch, they realize that as Agabus has prophesied, there is to be a famine in Judea, which, by the way, came to pass throughout all the world in the days of Claudius. And so the church in Antioch made a decision to send to the brethren that dwelt in Judea, sending it to the elders by the hands of Barnabas and Saul. Daniel, when the church at Antioch determined to send these funds, they determined, by the way, to send relief. When you read that passage and are making that point, don't miss that word. They didn't send money for recreation. They didn't send money so that folks could build a big elaborate building. They sent relief. Now, why did they send relief? Because there was a famine. Now, when they sent relief, who took it from this church to this one and this one and this one? Who took it? They sent it to the elders by the hands of Barnabas and Saul, or Paul and Barnabas. What were Barnabas and Saul in their relationship to the church at Antioch? All right, but what purpose did they serve? Messengers. That's all they were. Just messengers. Did Barnabas and Paul have the authority to say to this church, you know, Antioch's sending this to you, but we want you to do this with it? Now see, they didn't have any legislative authority over the funds. All they were was messengers. They were just messengers. Terry, comment?
Yeah, I'm just thinking about Elvis' decision to send
That's right. Got a chart on that when I get to it here. Go ahead.
And that in these various congregations had a need.
That's right.
That they could not fulfill.
That's right. I want you to notice that though it's a little dark and I should use a different color here, it says scriptural church cooperation in benevolence. Scriptural church cooperation.
Going back just a little bit, it said sent to the hands of the elders.
That's right. That's right.
We would have then necessarily stick with elders. What if the church did not have elders?
Well, if they didn't have elders, then they would deliver it to the church. And, of course, men have the role, not the same role as elders, but they have a responsibility in a church where there is not elders. And we see that described in 1 Timothy chapter 2, beginning at verse 8. As it discusses the roles of males and females. 1 Corinthians chapter 14, again, discussing roles of males and females. Now, I don't want to leave the impression that a group of men are a scriptural substitute for elders. That's not so. But in the absence of elders, where you don't have men qualified, then you can't appoint somebody that's not qualified just so you have elders. That won't work. That's not according to the pattern. So, in the absence of elders, you have men who help with conducting things according to a scriptural pattern until you reach the point where you have elders. Okay? Now, but here's a scriptural relationship between these churches. Now, I'm making this point for a reason. This is scriptural church cooperation in the realm of benevolence. This, too, is scriptural church cooperation in the realm of benevolence. Here you have a plurality of churches sending to the church in Jerusalem. Now, are they cooperating to relieve the need in Jerusalem? Yes. But we know that it's scriptural because here's the pattern. Here's the passages that teach it. Now, we might again identify that as scriptural church cooperation in the realm of benevolence. Now, here's what some do. Do you see any difference in these previous charts and this one? What is the difference?
Well, instead of straight sending,
Aren't the others sent straight to the other churches? The church has the authority to select the place, personnel, and provisions. Here we've got somebody else doing that. We've got churches reduced to nothing more than money raisers. They raise the money, send it to the benevolent society, or send it to the sponsoring church. And then the sponsoring church or the benevolent society chooses the place, the personnel, and the provisions. Now, Jonathan, you couldn't invite Richard and Linda to live with you, and Terry and I couldn't decide about what provisions they're going to need in terms of Randy or medical things that might be necessities for them, and we couldn't do that. You know why? Because all we can do is raise the money. We can send it to these folks, and they can decide these things. Now, do you see a problem in oversight in this arrangement? Do you? Now, there's the problem. You've got a problem in oversight. Now, I want you to look at this carefully. Unscriptural cooperation in church benevolence. Now, the previous charts we saw scriptural church cooperation. Why? We had all kinds of passages that illustrated the point. Showed us some examples of New Testament churches doing those very things. Can you find even one where this occurred? Now, you know, when you deal with some of these things, Donna pointed out something to me a couple of 3 weeks ago. I get a little passionate, maybe you've seen that once or twice, and teaching on these things. And I said, you know, I think sometimes folks that are in the class don't share the passion that I do about some of these things. Don't get as upset about it as I do. And she educated me about something. She said, well, for some time, you've been on the firing line of some of these things, fought some of the battles, and I have. I've been in public and private discussions of these very things. And when I say public discussions, I mean very public on television. You didn't know I could do that, did you? Well, that gets it pretty public. But the point being, I have been on the firing line of some of these things, fought some of the battles of some of these things, heard a lot of the arguments that are made. And just to show you how ludicrous some of these arguments go, you know, somebody when they're trying to establish a point that the Bible just don't teach, you've heard the expression grabbing at straws. That's what some folks do. For example, to illustrate the point, there are those who look at the travels of Paul when he came up through Macedonia and down to Achaia collecting these funds and then on over to Jerusalem. They said, well, right there is authority for a benevolent society. Well, yeah, Paul and Barnabas and those traveling with him, you remember, from Macedonia and Achaia. They said that constituted the board of directors and Paul was chairman of the board. Now, you chuckle at that. I heard that argument made. Now, what would you do in that kind of atmosphere where folks are pointing an accusing finger at you and calling you, well, you're an anti? Yeah. Well, you know, the problem is, and I'll get to you, Randy, sometimes folks say, well, if you don't agree with this, then you're anti-cooperation. And my response to that is, no, sir. I am not anti-cooperation. I am anti-unscriptural cooperation. The word anti simply means against. I am against anything that's not according to the Scriptures, aren't you? Care what it is. And if somebody wants to engage in some kind of arrangement in cooperating that I can't read in the Bible, then I'm against that, aren't you? All right, I got Randy and then Terry, I believe.
I was just going to answer the question. You said, what would you say if somebody made that argument that say, show me book, chapter, and verse, and I'll believe it?
I'd probably say, you're nuts. And then I would say that. But that's right. Terry and then Daryl, I believe, is the order we've got.
One way to remember the scriptural principles about this is keep in mind that Jesus said, I will build my church. Only one organization was established and built, and that was the church. There was no other organization established and built by Jesus.
That's right. That's right.
He didn't say I would build my church and missionary society or benevolent society.
That's right. That's right. Now, Richard's going to give me about 2 minutes here, aren't you?
Yeah, somewhere in that area.
All right, I don't want to take up the time stalling, so let's look at this. Here's what we've seen in the pattern. Acts 2, 4, and 6. One church supplying the needs that were among them. Acts chapter 11, verse 27 through 30. One church supplying the needs of several churches in the province of Judea. In these passages, we've got that reversed. We've got several churches supplying the needs of the needy among those in Jerusalem. What we do not have is this arrangement, where churches supplied to one either church or society, and then that church or society supplying the needs over here. You do not have that in the pattern. Here's what's wrong with that. This middleman right here. Whether you call it a society or whether you call it a sponsoring church, it has no place in all of the Bible. Now, Terry, very quickly, before we run out of time, you have made the point, and correctly so, that there's only one reason for one church sending to another church. Now, that's in this passage, 2 Corinthians 8, verse 14. I want you to go back and begin reading at verse 12, and let's get this point. 2 Corinthians chapter 8, beginning at verse 12. Before we close, you're going to let me finish this, aren't you, Richard? All right, Terry, you better read fast. Verse 12 through 14.
I got 45
seconds. Come on, Terry. All right, let's look at that very carefully. These churches sending to other churches, the purpose of that was that there might be equality. Now, the idea of equality was not that they'd have the same number of dollars and cents in their bank account, but they might all be free from want. There wouldn't be any needy members among any of them. Their destitute condition would be relieved. Now, you see that illustrated in that text where the people went out to pick up manna. And for every person in their family, they would pick up one omer per person. Now, I don't know what that measurement was, but it was one omer per person. If you had 10 people in your family, you picked up 10 omers. At the end of the day, everybody was fed, nobody was hungry. If you had 2 in your family, you went out and picked up 2 omers. At the end of the day, everybody was filled and fat. You see, nobody was hungry. That's equality. Isn't that simple? Now, that's the only reason in all of the Bible we see where one church sent to another church. And we're going to start on that next time. Okay?